December 2nd, 1993, Memphis, Tennessee. John Cheek, the 28-year-old financial officer of a real estate firm, spends the evening having a dinner at a restaurant and is last seen heading towards his parked car. The following day, John's abandoned vehicle is discovered near the Memphis and Arkansas Bridge, and there is fear that he took his own life by jumping into the Mississippi River. Months later, a drifter matching John's description is seen at a truck stop, leading to speculation that he may have suffered a mental breakdown and forgotten who he was. But all attempts to find him are unsuccessful. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring two missing persons cases which were featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1993 disappearance of John Cheek and the 1991 disappearance of Gordon Collins. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Marco Sainz, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Marcos. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for nearly 6 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. So the disappearance of John Cheek was one of the cases that Marcos requested that I cover when he originally entered this contest, and since there isn't a ton of information available, I've decided to combine this case with the unsolved disappearance of Gordon Collins. The main thing these two cases have in common is that they involved victims who had supposedly been acting disoriented sometime after they went missing, creating speculation that they may have been suffering from some sort of amnesia and had forgotten who they were. And at the time these stories were originally profiled on Unsolved Mysteries, the victims' loved ones were hoping that they might still be alive out there somewhere. What was particularly unusual about John Cheek's case is that he was on the verge of helping complete a major deal for his employer, which would have made him a millionaire. Since John's abandoned car was found near a bridge overlooking the Mississippi River, the initial theory surrounding his disappearance was that it was a suicide brought on by severe stress, but a unique sighting of John at a truck stop a few months later opened up the possibility that he may have somehow lost his memory and become a transient. On the surface, the disappearance of Gordon Collins did not seem like much of a mystery, as he vanished after a storm capsized his boat during a fishing trip to Mexico. However, Gordon's body was never found, and there would eventually be sightings of a white male matching Gordon's description, aimlessly wandering through numerous locations throughout the country. So once again, there was speculation that Gordon may have survived the accident and made it to shore, but the traumatic experience caused him to develop amnesia and forget who he was. Whatever the case, neither of these victims have ever been found. Anyway, I'll start off this episode by sharing John's story before I move on to Gordon's disappearance, and then I'll provide my theories and analysis for both these cases. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. Also, I just wanted to mention that this coming Saturday, May the 6th, we'll be holding one of our annual Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons, in which I'll be screening classic episodes from the show, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. The live watch begins at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes or at the top of our social media pages. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the disappearance of John Cheek. Our first story begins in Memphis, Tennessee in 1993, and our first victim is 28-year-old John Cheek. Originally born in Memphis, John moved to Dallas in order to obtain a bachelor's degree at Southern Methodist University, and then earned a master's in business administration at the University of Chicago. John subsequently returned to Memphis and has spent the past 3 years working as the chief financial officer for a real estate firm called the Cates Company, which manages 24 apartment complexes in several southern states worth more than $100 million. John is described as being a very driven and talkative workaholic, and one of his major responsibilities was to help negotiate a deal which would allow the Cates Company to go public and convert to a real estate investment trust called Mid-America Apartment Communities Incorporated. This task absolutely consumed John's life, as he spent months traveling throughout the United States and other countries in order to meet and work with investors, and he would sometimes put in 18-hour days. However, if the deal was successful, John believed that all the hard work would be worth it, as it would raise his annual salary to $110,000 per year and give him $2 million in stock options. Near the end of November, the deal was close to completion, and John left on a 3-day business trip to Milwaukee, Denver, and Portland, Oregon, in order to help work out the final details. However, in the midst of the trip, John was informed that the deal would be delayed due to some questions from the Securities and Exchange Commission over a tax issue. Upon hearing the news, John immediately took a late-night flight back to Memphis and arrived at 6 a.m. on the morning of December the 1st. He then went to his company's headquarters and spent most of the day working, telling his colleagues that he had been awake for 72 straight hours. When evening rolled around, John agreed to accompany his co-workers to a downtown restaurant called The Cooker for dinner. While there, John gradually became intoxicated, and at around 11 p.m., he left the restaurant, and one of his associates accompanied him across the street to the Crescent Center, where he had parked his charcoal gray 1987 Acura Legend. They then parted ways, but even though John's house was only located 2 miles away, this would turn out to be the last time he was confirmed to be alive. The following morning, John did not show up for work at his office, and when he failed to surface, his co-workers decided to contact his parents, Richard and Irina Cheek. They went to check John's house and discovered he was not there, and the suitcases he had brought home from his business trip were still unpacked. While John's car was not at the residence, the garage door was open, even though he always made sure to close it whenever he left. Well, by the morning of December the 3rd, John's parents were still unable to get a hold of him, so they officially filed a missing persons report with the Memphis Police Department. Well, at 10:40 a.m. the following day, the police received a report about John's Acura Legend being found abandoned on Interstate 55 next to the Delaware Street exit ramp off Crump Boulevard. It was parked 50 feet away from the Memphis and Arkansas Bridge, which crossed over the Mississippi River. There were no signs of any struggle or foul play, and the car was locked and appeared to be in perfect working order. The location was 12 miles from John's home, and since he didn't seem to have any apparent connection to the area, his loved ones had no idea why he would have driven there. But of course, there was immediate speculation from police that the stress surrounding John's deal with the Cates Company had caused him to become suicidal and prompted him to take his own life by jumping off the Memphis and Arkansas Bridge into the river. However, John's loved ones did not agree with this theory and believed he had shown no signs of being suicidal. An extensive search of the Mississippi River failed to turn up any trace of John's body, and 2 months later, a new development would occur to suggest that John might still be alive and had forgotten who he was. On February the 14th, 1994, a truck driver named Ron Jackson arrived at a truck stop in West Memphis, Arkansas, where he noticed a missing persons flyer for John, which had been posted. Jackson then contacted the authorities to inform them that he was certain he had seen John the previous day at White 76 Truck Stop in Rafine, Virginia, located over 700 miles away. Jackson said that he came across a drifter who was sleeping on a chair in the CB radio shop and decided to wake him up. He asked the man if he could buy him breakfast, and the drifter took him up on his offer. According to Jackson, the man did not resemble your average drifter, as he was dressed in a white shirt and tie and carrying a bundle of clothes bound neatly by a belt. When he spoke, Jackson also thought he came across as eloquent and well-educated, but still sensed that there was something off about him mentally. The drifter never told Jackson his name, but said he had recently lived in a homeless shelter in Little Rock and had been hitchhiking with truckers in order to travel to Richmond. While Jackson offered him a ride, it turned out they were headed in opposite directions, so the two men parted ways. However, when Jackson arrived in West Memphis the following day and saw John Cheek's missing persons flyer, he became convinced that this was the same man he had spoken to in Rafine. One detail which seemed to add credibility to Jackson's sighting is that he described the drifter as wearing slip-on, topside, or moccasins, as a pair of moccasins matching that description had disappeared from John's house the same time he did, and this detail had never been released publicly at that point. Jackson's account convinced John's family that he might still be alive somewhere and suffering from amnesia. They speculated that the stress of the business deal became so overwhelming that John's mind reacted by blocking out his identity. This caused him to start suffering from a dissociative disorder known as the fugue state, so he lost his memory and forgot who he was, and was now wandering around disoriented and confused. While John had no known history of mental illness, prior to his disappearance, he told people he had gone months without a full night's sleep, even though his family warned him that his lifestyle could be putting his health at risk. When the authorities circulated John's photos at the White 76 truck stop in Rafine, other witnesses would recall having seen him there. The truck stop's cashier said she had seen the drifter hanging around for a few days prior to Jackson's arrival, and while the truck stop's manager initially made a positive identification and was certain the drifter was John, he later retracted this identification and said he wasn't entirely sure. Regardless, this new development added some urgency to the investigation, so on April the 20th, just 2 months after the sighting of John, his story would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. On August the 22nd, a waitress in Bend, Oregon, who watched a rerun of the Unsolved Mysteries segment, reported having spoken to a man at a restaurant whom she was convinced was John. She said the man told her he had to get back to Memphis to appear in court over a traffic ticket, and John did have a traffic court date scheduled in Memphis 9 days after he originally vanished. In January of 1995, a woman who had viewed another re-airing of the Unsolved Mysteries segment came forward with another surprising story. She claimed that on December the 1st, 1993, the night John went missing, she had seen two robbers attacking a man who resembled him near the Memphis and Arkansas Bridge. She said the robbers hit him over the head and took his wallet, and when the man got back up, he hailed the first car which passed by before hitching a ride from the scene. However, this woman's story was never substantiated, and even though there would be a number of reported sightings of John, he was never tracked down. There was no activity on his credit cards, and none of the money in his bank account was ever touched. So after being missing for nearly 7 years, John was legally declared dead in August of 2000. In a final postscript to this story, even though the deal John had been working on was delayed by the Securities and Exchange Commission, an audit of the Cates Company turned up no sign of illegal activity or wrongdoing from John. As a result, the tax issue which had caused the delay was resolved, and the deal finally went through, as the Cates Company went national and was rebranded as Mid-America Apartment Communities Incorporated. According to the company's owner, George Cates, quote, "They did an exhaustive audit and not a pencil was missing. There was no hint of wrongdoing, and of course there wasn't. He did a great job. He did the job wonderfully when he was there. He left a great legacy," end quote. Nearly 30 years later, Mid-America Apartment Communities now owns over 300 apartment communities, making it the largest owner of apartments in the United States and one of the largest apartment property managers. It also trades on the New York Stock Exchange and currently has a market capitalization of over $17 billion. Unfortunately, since John could not be found, he never got to receive any of the financial rewards he was entitled to for his hard work, and he continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. And now let's move on to our next case. Our second story begins in 1991, and our second victim is 34-year-old Gordon Collins, who hails from Moreno Valley, California. Gordon has a 10-year-old son named Christopher from a previous relationship, and is currently dating a woman named Anastasia Seals. On April the 15th, Gordon and Anastasia decided to leave on a vacation to Santa Rosalia, Mexico, a deep-sea fishing port located in the state of Baja California Sur, on the east coast of the Baja California Peninsula. They were accompanied on their trip by another couple from San Marcos, California, 42-year-old Wayne Schwartz and his 38-year-old fiancée Arlene Burlington, and they would all stay on some seafront property that Wayne owned. On April the 19th, the four friends traveled south to the small village of Punta Chivato in order to take a fishing trip in the Gulf of California, aka the Sea of Cortez. Wayne had fished in the area many times, so they went out in a 22-foot powerboat he owned and left the port at the Hotel Punta Chivato at around noon that day. However, as they were leaving, they passed by a fisherman in another boat who informed them that a storm was about to hit the area. Since the weather was still calm at that time, the group apparently believed they would be able to make it back before the storm arrived, so they continued to head into the peninsula. Well, sure enough, a few hours later, the area would be hit with a storm consisting of 40-knot winds, which caused some 12-foot-high waves, and the group's boat did not return as scheduled. After some of their friends reported them missing the following day, the Hotel Punta Chivato sent one of their employees out on a boat to search for them. He eventually came across an overturned powerboat and Wayne and Anastasia's bodies floating in the Sea of Cortez. The spot was about 28 miles northeast of Punta Chivato and just over a mile away from an island called Isla San Marcos. Some additional paraphernalia from the boat, including a life jacket and an ice chest, were found within the same square-mile radius, but there was no trace of Gordon or Arlene's bodies. Since Wayne and Anastasia were found wearing life jackets, and two other life jackets from the boat were unaccounted for, it was reasonable to assume that Gordon and Arlene were wearing theirs as well. Since the temperature in the Sea of Cortez was about 70 degrees, it was believed that a person with a life jacket would survive in the water for between 12 to 36 hours before they succumbed to hypothermia. For the next 3 days, the United States Coast Guard would search a 250-mile area of the Baja California Peninsula, but found no trace of Gordon or Arlene. Regardless, it seemed likely that the two missing victims had drowned, so the U.S. consulate in Tijuana asked both of their families to send them the necessary documentation in order to prepare death certificates for them to sign. However, Gordon's parents, John and Mary Lou Collins, did not want to declare their son dead, as they started learning about numerous eyewitness sightings of an unidentified white male matching Gordon's description who was apparently wandering through Mexico. In many of these sightings, the man was described as resembling a transient who appeared to be disoriented, so this made Gordon's family believe he may not have drowned after all and managed to make it back to shore. But the trauma of the ordeal may have caused him to develop amnesia and enter the fugue state, so he no longer had any memory of who he was. John and Mary Lou decided to travel from California to Mexico in order to perform a search and distribute missing persons flyers for Gordon, and they would encounter a number of witnesses who recalled seeing him. The most interesting sighting was from a pair of fishermen who reported having seen a man matching Gordon's description emerging from the Sea of Cortez at a location which was about a mile and a half away from where Wayne and Anastasia's bodies had been discovered. They said he was shirtless, dressed only in shorts, and was covered in cuts, and after he exited the water, he headed towards a nearby bus and made an attempt to board it. John and Mary Lou also spoke to another witness named Jose Peralta, who recalled seeing this same shirtless man on a nearby beach during the same approximate time period he had been seen by the two fishermen. Peralta claimed that the man approached him and said he was waiting for some friends he had gone fishing with. Since he was cold, the man asked Peralta if he could have his blanket in order to keep warm and sleep on the beach to wait for his friends, so Peralta let him take it. Unfortunately, John and Mary Lou had no luck actually tracking Gordon down, so they returned home to California, but shortly thereafter, they started receiving phone calls about more eyewitness sightings of Gordon, many of which took place in La Paz, which is the capital of Baja California Sur, and located over 300 miles south from where Gordon was last seen. Gordon's parents traveled to La Paz to perform another investigation, but before they arrived in the city, they showed Gordon's photo to a worker at a taco stand, and he told them he had seen Gordon just 1 hour earlier. John and Mary Lou then headed in the direction where Gordon had supposedly been going, and after traveling about 3 or 4 miles, they spoke to another witness who recognized Gordon's photo and recalled having seen him just a half hour earlier. After arriving in La Paz, John and Mary Lou soon encountered another witness who informed them he had seen Gordon just 5 minutes earlier, but after that, they said that everyone they spoke to pretty much just clammed up, and they were unable to obtain any further information or track Gordon down. Over the next 3 months, there would be no less than 50 reported sightings of Gordon in 7 different locations throughout Mexico, and the majority of them took place in either La Paz or Cabo San Lucas, which is located just under 100 miles away on the southern end of the Baja California Peninsula. This caused speculation that Gordon may have been trying to disappear intentionally and was actively avoiding his parents whenever they searched for him. However, Gordon's loved ones did not believe this, as he had phoned his parents on the day he left on his vacation to Mexico to let them know where he was, and they found it unlikely that he would have deserted his son, Christopher. John and Mary Lou decided to hire a private investigator named Bill Garcia, who alerted a number of newspapers in Baja California about Gordon's disappearance. After these papers ran articles about his story in September of 1991, Garcia started receiving calls from Colonia Vicente Guerrero, a village located near the west coast of Baja California, about 175 miles south of the United States-Mexico border. Several witnesses were certain they had seen a white male resembling Gordon wandering around the area during the preceding 4 or 5 months, and he was described as looking disoriented and living off handouts and the charity of strangers. When Garcia showed Gordon's photograph to witnesses who had seen or spoke to the man, he said they were certain it was him. The most interesting eyewitness account was provided by James Hatfield, an American who lived in Colonia Vicente Guerrero. The man resembling Gordon was arrested for stealing food, and since he did not appear to speak Spanish, the local sheriff brought Hatfield to the jail to translate for him. According to Hatfield, the man did not reveal too much information about himself, but he did say his name was Gordy, which was Gordon's nickname. When shown a photo of Gordon, Hatfield was certain it was the same man he had interacted with. Unfortunately, by the time Garcia visited the jail where the man had been incarcerated, he was already released. Even though the U.S. consulate in Tijuana initially believed that Gordon drowned and wanted his family to sign his death certificate, the large number of sightings caused the consulate to reverse their position and state that they no longer automatically presumed Gordon to be dead. The case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in September of 1993, and at that time, the last reported sighting of Gordon had been in Rosarito, which was about 12 miles south of Tijuana. John and Mary Lou Collins offered a $5,000 reward for information, and in total, they estimated that they had spent over $100,000 of their own money searching for Gordon. But sadly, their efforts did not pay off, and Mary Lou passed away in 1999. So after more than 30 years, there are still no conclusive answers about what actually happened to Gordon Collins. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So just under a year ago, I released episode number 283 of The Trail Went Cold, which covered the unsolved disappearances of Gordon Page Jr. and Christy Krebs, and that episode had a similar structure to this one. They both featured a pair of missing persons cases which were featured on episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, and at the time they originally aired, there was a decent possibility that the victim was still alive out there somewhere, possibly living as a disoriented transient who had suffered some sort of mental breakdown and forgotten who they were. However, 3 decades have now passed, and Gordon Page Jr., Christy Krebs, John Cheek, and Gordon Collins have all never been found, so the chances of any of them still being alive after all these years are incredibly remote. Now, since Goran Page Jr. and Christy Krebs went missing after wandering off, there were a number of possibilities about what might have happened to them, but the disappearances of John Cheek and Goran Collins are a bit different. In both cases, there is potentially a simple and logical explanation to account for their disappearances. John Cheek may have taken his own life by jumping off the Memphis and Arkansas Bridge into the Mississippi River, and Goran Collins may have drowned when the storm capsized his boat and his body has never been found. However, since there seemed to be reasonably convincing eyewitness sightings of these two individuals after they went missing, their stories wound up being featured on Unsolved Mysteries. The show had a particularly quick turnaround time when it came to producing a segment about John's disappearance, as he vanished in December of 1993, was spotted at the truck stop in February of 1994, and the segment aired in April of 1994. It seemed like everyone believed there was a genuine chance that John was still alive somewhere, and felt that if his story received exposure on national television, someone would come forward and provide the necessary information for him to be found safely. But sadly, this never came to fruition. Of course, John's disappearance is particularly unusual because he happened to go missing at a time when everything seemed to be going good in his life and he was on the verge of completing a major business deal which would have made him a millionaire. John's parents were interviewed on the Unsolved Mysteries segment, and when the theory was pushed forward about his disappearance being the result of a suicide, they instantly discounted it and maintained that John did not have any suicidal tendencies and was not the type of person who would do that. Well, needless to say, I've now studied enough of these cases to know that you should never, ever completely discount the possibility of suicide, even when the victim seems to be in a good place and shows no outward signs of depression or mental illness. Sometimes, suicidal people just don't give off any warning signs and take their loved ones by complete surprise when they decide to go through with it. Now, since John is technically still a missing person, we can't say with 100% certainty that this is what happened, but when you put the pieces of the puzzle together, they do point towards a suicide scenario. By all accounts, John was a major workaholic and had apparently gone without sleep for 72 hours before he disappeared. You have to factor in that when he was last seen, John had gotten intoxicated during a dinner with his work colleagues, a key detail which was conveniently not mentioned during the Unsolved Mysteries segment. The last time John was confirmed to be alive was when a colleague escorted him to his parked car, and even though John was drunk, his house was located only 2 miles away, so his colleague may have figured he would be okay to drive home. However, John's abandoned car was discovered about 10 to 12 miles away at the Memphis and Arkansas Bridge, a location he would seemingly have no reason to visit. Even though the car was not impounded by police until December the 4th, witnesses did recall seeing it there as early as December the 2nd, hours after John was last seen alive. I guess it's possible that John could have been the victim of foul play, and someone else abandoned his car at that location, but there's no evidence to point to that scenario at all. In December of 2003, the Memphis-based newspaper, The Commercial Appeal, published a 10-year anniversary article about John's disappearance, containing comments from J.D. Douglas, a retired homicide commander turned private investigator who had been hired by John's parents. After an extensive investigation, Douglas concluded, quote, "I think he went off the bridge. For this period of time, it's awfully hard for anybody to hide," end quote. Now, one of the most tragic things about this story is that the business deal John had been helping negotiate for his employer could not have turned out better in the long run, as the company went national and is worth billions nearly 30 years later. But at the time he vanished, John could not have been certain this would happen, since the deal wound up being delayed due to the intervention of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Details are still vague about what exactly their issue was, but in the end, they found no evidence of any wrongdoing. The deal still went through as planned, and if John had not gone missing, I'm sure he would have reaped the rewards. Of course, if John had been doing something illegal, and he believed this new investigation was going to ruin him, then I can certainly understand that being a potential motive for suicide. But why would he go through with it if he never actually did anything wrong? Well, I think that would depend on his state of mind at the time. Remember, John had devoted the last several months of his life to working on this deal, and if it was derailed in any way, I'm sure that would have absolutely crushed him. He had often been working 18-hour days, rarely ever got a full night's sleep, and had been awake for 72 straight hours before he vanished. When you couple all that in with the fact that he became intoxicated, then I can definitely believe that John was not in the most rational state of mind and was envisioning a doomsday scenario for this deal. This could have led to John believing that suicide was the only option, but on the other hand, these factors could have also contributed to John suffering a complete mental breakdown and entering the fugue state, causing him to block out his memory and forget who he was. In addition, we also have the account from the eyewitness who claimed she saw a man matching John's description getting assaulted and robbed near the Memphis and Arkansas Bridge on the night of his disappearance before he hitched a ride with another vehicle. Could it be possible that this assault caused John to suffer a serious head injury and develop amnesia? Well, I'm actually quite skeptical of this witness's story, since she never contacted the police, and it took her over a year to come forward. And even if she is telling the truth about having witnessed the incident, how do we know that she didn't see another man get assaulted besides John? My main problem with this theory is that there's no logical reason for John to have driven to the Memphis and Arkansas Bridge, so what would he have even been doing there to begin with? Theoretically, if John had been planning suicide by jumping off the bridge, it would be one hell of a coincidence if he wound up getting assaulted and losing his memory before this could happen. But getting back to the amnesia theory, the reason this scenario was given credence was because of the eyewitness sighting from Ron Jackson, who was certain he had seen John at a truck stop in Raphine, Virginia, 2 months after he went missing. I will say that Ron Jackson seems like an absolute sweetheart and one of the most likable people ever interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, and he definitely comes across as the type of guy who would buy breakfast for a random stranger who appeared down on his luck. But just because a person is a sweetheart does not mean they are immune from having their memory play tricks on them. We've seen this same situation countless times in missing persons cases, and while I don't have the exact numbers for this sort of thing, I'd wager that the vast majority of eyewitness sightings in these cases are mistaken. The witnesses are usually well-meaning people who genuinely believe they've seen a missing person and want to help, but it's so easy to misremember a person's face. I have no doubt that Jackson's story is true, as there were other witnesses who recalled seeing this drifter at the truck stop in Raphine, but Jackson did not see John Cheek's missing poster until he was in another city the following day, so he easily could have mixed him up for someone else. I will say that the most compelling piece of evidence that the drifter might have been John is the fact that he was wearing a pair of slip-on topsider moccasins, as John wore a similar pair of moccasins which supposedly went missing from his residence. From what I can tell about the timeline on the day John went missing, he returned to Memphis after a late-night flight, dropped off his suitcases at his house without unpacking them, went straight to his office and worked the entire day before he went out to dinner with his colleagues. Since moccasins are usually meant to be worn around the house, I have my doubts that John would wear them to work or dinner, but since his garage door was uncharacteristically left open, I don't discount the possibility that John did return home at some point after he parted ways with his work colleagues at dinner. But even if he was suffering from mental health issues, would he really put on a pair of moccasins, drive to the Memphis and Arkansas Bridge, abandon his car, and then hitch a ride out of town? I also have to wonder how John's parents could have been so certain that a pair of moccasins were missing from his house. Were they really that familiar with every piece of footwear he owned? Even though I was a lot more open to the amnesia theory back in the mid-1990s, the fact that no conclusive evidence has ever surfaced to prove that John is still alive makes me lean towards his disappearance being a suicide in which he jumped off the bridge into the Mississippi River. Even though a search failed to turn up his body, the Mississippi River is a very large body of water, so I could easily see his body being missed. Of course, if that is what happened, then John's death is an incredibly tragic story, but like his former boss said, John played a major role in helping turn his employer into a multi-billion dollar company. Even though he was only on this earth for 28 years, he accomplished an awful lot during his short life and left behind a great legacy. But I think this shows that even the most successful people are not immune from potential mental health issues which could drive them to take their own life. All that being said, if you happen to have any information on the disappearance of John Cheek, please contact the Memphis Police Department at 901-545-5700. That's 901-545-5700. So now let's move on and start talking about what happened to Gordon Collins. Unfortunately, other than the Unsolved Mystery segment and a couple of contemporary news articles in California-based publications, there is very little information out there about this case, so I've always had a ton of unanswered questions. Like I mentioned earlier, under normal circumstances, this would ordinarily seem like nothing more than a tragic boating accident. Even though Gordon's body has never been found, the Sea of Cortez is a marginal sea of the Pacific Ocean, so if his body managed to float out that far, it could easily have been lost forever. But even though I just went on about how unreliable eyewitness sightings and missing persons cases can be, it's hard to completely discount all the sightings here of the man matching Gordon's description. They're a little different from the norm, since they involve the white American male wandering throughout Mexico, which is bound to draw additional attention, and one witness even claimed that he flat out interacted with this man and heard him say his name was Gordy. There really isn't that much information out there about Gordon as a person, and we only know that he had a 10-year-old son named Christopher because they briefly showed a photo of the two of them together on Unsolved Mysteries. We know virtually nothing about Gordon's girlfriend, Anastasia Seals, and many of the articles I found from that time period share more information about Wayne Schwartz and Arlene Burlington, since it was Wayne's boat which was involved in the accident. Gordon's mother Mary Lou has long since passed away, but I believe his father John is still alive and used to be involved with a Facebook page titled Help Find Gordon Collins. The page has not been updated in a few years, but every now and then, people would share photographs of homeless-looking white men they had encountered in Mexico and bring up the possibility that they might be Gordon, but these leads never went anywhere. Even if by some miracle Gordon did not drown in the boating accident and made it back to shore, the odds of him still being alive and wandering the streets of Mexico over 30 years later are pretty remote. One thing about the Unsolved Mystery segment I've always found odd is how little attention they paid to the other missing victim from the accident, Arlene Burlington. It's easy to forget that Arlene's body was also never found, as she's barely even mentioned during the segment, but obituaries and memorial tributes for Arlene were published in various California newspapers in the weeks following the accident. However, during my research, it took me by complete surprise when I learned that there were some reported sightings of Gordon and Arlene together. In the June 17, 1992 edition of the San Diego Union-Tribune, private investigator Bill Garcia stated that in addition to the numerous reported sightings of Gordon while he was alive, a man and woman matching Gordon and Arlene's descriptions had been seen panhandling together in Cabo San Lucas, La Paz, and other towns in Baja California Sur. Gordon and Arlene were both known for being excellent swimmers, so John and Mary Lou were holding out hope that they made it to shore after the boating accident or were picked up by another fishing boat who took them to safety. However, the article did confirm that Arlene's family had accepted the official conclusion that she drowned and did not believe she was still alive, so I can understand why these sightings of Arlene were not mentioned during the Unsolved Mystery segment. Arlene was a very distinctive-looking woman, as she was Japanese-American and only 5 feet tall, so I can understand why seeing a woman like that alongside a white American male would stand out in Mexico. But if Gordon and Arlene both survived, it really doesn't make much sense that they would be living transient lifestyles together, because what are the odds that both of them would have lost their memories and they were both suffering from amnesia? I seriously doubt that Gordon and Arlene, or Gordon himself for that matter, would use this opportunity to disappear voluntarily and start a new life. I just mentioned that we don't know all that much about Gordon's personal life, but even so, I cannot imagine his life in California could have been so bad that he would willingly choose to become a homeless drifter in Mexico who lived off handouts. Not to mention the fact that Gordon's disappearance took place after an unpredictable weather event which took the lives of his girlfriend and his friends. After being on a boat that overturned during a storm, I seriously doubt he would swim to shore and say, well, this is the perfect opportunity to start a new life. No, I definitely believe that if Gordon did survive this event and was the man seen wandering through Mexico, the trauma likely caused him to lose his memory. As unlikely as the scenario sounds, we had two fishermen who supposedly saw a man matching Gordon's description emerging from the Sea of Cortez near the location where the overturned boat and the bodies were found. And we also have the witness who interacted with this man and claimed that he looked disoriented and said he was waiting for some friends to return from fishing. If these sightings are accurate, then they are definitely compelling, but the big question is, were these witnesses actually being truthful about what they saw? Well, when John and Mary Lou Collins traveled to Mexico, they spoke with a lot of witnesses who told them they had seen Gordon, but they never managed to track him down. While it's possible that some of these witnesses did legitimately see a white male drifter whom they mistook for Gordon, I do have to wonder if some of them may have decided to take advantage of the Collinses. It's been reported that John and Mary Lou spent over $100,000 of their own money searching for their son, but it's not clear to me if they ever paid any of the people they encountered for information. Because if word spread that these Americans were spreading money throughout the area, I could see some of the local residents feeding them false stories in order to string them along and send them on a wild goose chase. One of the biggest issues with these sightings is how spread out they were. Gordon was seen by multiple people in La Paz, which is over 300 miles south from where the boat overturned, and he was also seen in Cabo San Lucas, which is around 100 miles south of La Paz. But the next slew of sightings, as well as Gordon's supposed arrest for stealing food, took place in Colonia Vicente Guerrero, which is around 700 to 800 miles northwest of these locations. That seems like an awful lot of traveling for a confused drifter with no resources at his disposal. But I will say that the sighting of Gordon at the jail in Colonia Vicente Guerrero is the most convincing one, since it was provided by another American, James Hatfield, who claimed that this man said his name was Gordy and positively identified Gordon from his photograph. Would Hatfield really have the motivation to lie about something like this? And if he is telling the truth, what are the odds of another similar-looking American drifter named Gordy wandering aimlessly through Mexico? This entire lead came about after Bill Garcia, a private investigator that the Collinses hired, circulated Gordon's photo in the local newspapers, and I started to wonder if he may have been fabricating these sightings in order to provide false hope to John and Mary Lou and extort more money out of them. However, during my research, I discovered that in 1998, the family of a man named John Stephen Weingarten hired Garcia to find him, as Weingarten had a history of mental illness and had been missing since he walked out of a state mental hospital 12 years earlier. As you can imagine, the odds of finding him alive after all that time probably seemed very slim, but the search effort did pay off, as Weingarten was discovered to be living on the streets of San Francisco as a homeless transient and wound up reuniting with his family. So after that success story, I think I'd stop short at calling Garcia a scam artist and believe he was legitimately trying to find Gordon. All that being said, even though Gordon was described as being an excellent swimmer, if his boat was overturned by 40-knot winds, which caused 12-foot-high waves, it still would have been extremely difficult for him to successfully swim to shore in those conditions. Even though Gordon's body was never found during the Coast Guard search effort, let's not forget that Arlene Burlington's body was not found either, and I pretty much completely discount all the sightings of her being alive in Mexico at a later time. So if her body could be lost forever, who's to say that Gordon's wouldn't be as well? I don't know. I do find some of the sightings of Gordon to be interesting, particularly the one from the jail, and I think there were far too many of them for me to believe that every single witness was lying. There is a decent chance that a man matching Gordon's description was aimlessly wandering through Mexico during that time period, but it's possible that it was a completely different individual. And even if by chance it was Gordon, the odds are not great that he would still be alive after all this time. Much like the John Cheek case, I am inclined to lean towards the simplest explanation and believe that Gordon drowned in the boating accident and his body was just never found. But until this can be conclusively proven, I guess we can never know for certain, so if you happen to have any information on the disappearance of Gordon Collins, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Marco Sainz for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released an episode about the 1910 disappearance of Conradina Olsen, which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and explored the possibility that she was a Jane Doe who was allegedly murdered next to some railroad tracks and buried in an unmarked grave. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1967 murder of Ralph Probst. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Francesca V., Kimberly R., Kimberly S., Catlin M., and Christopher Z. Thank you all so much for your support. Another reminder that later this year, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th, at the Doubletree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. We've got a specialized promo code which you can use in order to get a 15% discount on tickets to the event, so if you would like to purchase them, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use our promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's True Crime Podcast Festival, and the promo code is TRAIL. And one more reminder that this coming weekend, we'll also be holding one of our Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons on Saturday, May the 6th, in which I'll be screening classic segments from Unsolved Mysteries, including the two cases from today's episode, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. The Live Watch begins at 8 p.m. Eastern Time this coming Saturday, and you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes or pinned to the top of our social media pages. Hope to see you there! I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.